Hello and welcome to Adoptee Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, I chat to Dawn, an adult adoptee, and she shares her experience of being adopted in the late 1960s. Dawn describes her strength of feeling about adoption from a young age, her decision to seek out her birth parents, and how adoption has impacted her and her family throughout her life. We hope you find it interesting, and if you're an adoptee and would like to share your perspective or experience, then please do direct messages at our Twitter feed or in our Facebook page.
Hello, I'm Dawn. I'm a mum of 10, one family, one TV, and yes, my husband goes to work. I was adopted at 6 weeks. I always knew that I was adopted, and I can't remember not knowing, though I have gone through my head. And I was always the odd one out. It was very obvious to me that, particularly from my mum, that I was, you know, second, because they had a biological son 2 years after they had me. And whether or not it would have made any difference if he'd been there or not, I don't know. But I knew I was second best, and that was quite open, you know, that I was quite aware of that even as a very, very young child. I knew that. So I was always not fighting, but, you know, trying to go that extra step at school or wherever it was. It was always trying to go that people-pleasing route, I think would be the word for it. I took for a long while. And then as I got older, I'm 52 now, so I've got quite a lot of different stages in my life and different views on adoption. I've always been against adoption. Even when I was three or four, I can remember thinking, you know, this isn't right. This isn't, you know, this just is not right the way a family should be. And I was three or four. I know, and I can remember going to school, so I would have been four in reception, and I can remember very clearly thinking, this isn't right. And so I built, I think, in my head an imaginary world with an imaginary family, and I think that was my disassociation way. But I didn't, obviously didn't know then that that's what it was. It was disassociation. So I've had extensive mental health problems throughout my life, but that's only when you go back retrospectively, because obviously I'm going back a long way and it just wasn't recognised then. It's only, you know, mental health has been a very current thing for the last, what, 5, 10 years even, not even 10 years. So my eldest daughter is now 31 and my youngest daughter is 5, and within that time period I've seen a huge amount of changes: education, health, the way people are, and also adoption. So my adopted dad died in January of this year. He was 84. He'd had a good innings, and he had cancer the last 2 years, and he didn't want treatment. And I agreed with him. I said, Dad, you've got to go watch with What's Right with You. But my adopted mum and obviously her son, my brother, they pushed and pushed and pushed that he did this, he did that, he did the other, and he just didn't want it, and nobody would listen except me. And obviously I was in a minority of one, so that was me out of the equation. So at that point, you know, my husband had always said, you know, just leave him to it, because he knew how much I've raged over the years about being second best, and he knows. And I'd said to him hundreds of times, you know, it's not equal, I'm second best. And I don't think he believed me until January of this year. And we've been married 31 years, and it wasn't until this year that he finally saw and he said, yeah, I think you're right, Dawn. So when my dad died in January, because of the two of them, my mum and my dad, he was the one who was probably fairest to me, but certainly my mum was. And it just turned things upside down. He didn't call me that night when my dad was dying, he called me after he died, so I didn't get the opportunity to go. So I was cut out of all the funeral arrangements. And when my husband spoke to my brother, he said, you need to involve Dawn. This is her dad as well. You need to involve Dawn. And so my brother sent me a list about which chapel should we have, flowers, and that was it. And so I said, I think you've managed this far. Get on with it. And that was it. And it was by chance I'd gone to see my mum, and I'd rang her, and I said, well, shall I come tomorrow? No, I don't need you. I don't need you. And that absolutely cut me in half. At 52, it verified what I'd gone through for 52 years. She didn't need me. And even though I've got my family, she said that on a few occasions, I don't need you. I was absolutely cut in half, even though I knew it. So I said to my brother, that's it, get on with it. So I thought at that point, that's it, cut ties.
That sounds like a really difficult experience. And clearly it's a confirmation of how you've always felt. And a very physical manifestation of what you've thought about that dynamic. Well, since you were even three, and I'm really intrigued by this little girl who at 3 and 4 knew it was wrong, or that's how she perceived adoption. What was it that you thought was wrong at that age?
So obviously I would have known I was adopted.
Yeah.
And I used to hate my brother because he knew who his mum and dad were, and I didn't know. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know who I was. And it was that craving for that physical contact, that physical love, because it's an unending craving for that physical contact and for that affirmation that you loved and that you wanted. You know, I was told that, we wanted you because nobody else wanted you, so you're special. So my thinking around that was I wasn't wanted. Nobody wanted me. That's it. Second best.
So what they thought was a positive message, you actually took out of that just a wholly negative message. That actually, it's the wrong sentence, isn't it? In saying we wanted you because no one wanted you, all you heard was no one wanted you.
Yes, that was it. And so I knew I wasn't wanted, and I knew I didn't fit. I knew I wasn't like all the other children. You know, when they'd go to their mums and stuff, I'd watched that from a very young child, and it just wasn't there. That bond was nothing. There was no bond, nothing. So whereas my children have all got that bond, and it is very, very strong in my children, with between them and myself, I had nothing.
Has that feeling of you as the little girl and that own childhood and all through your life, has that sort of impacted on how you as a parent? Has it influenced?
Completely. It's completely, because I remember, and I know I was 4 at the time, thinking, when I grow up and have children and have a family, I'm not going to do it like this. I'm going to do it differently. I made a decision.
That's really, I mean, those are really quite insightful and quite, you know, quite definite thoughts for such a young child. And did you articulate that to people around you, or did you feel you could?
Because the A word was just... You couldn't go near the adoption word at all. Even now, it's like if I try and ask, if I ask anything, even remotely close, like a million miles away, but you're going step towards that, my mum just won't speak. She'll say, I can't remember.
Well, that's really complicated, isn't it? Because I guess then if you have... If there's a vacuum, you fill it.
Yeah.
Basically. So what...
Obviously, I didn't.
Well, in the sense that you fill it with your own decisions and choices and perception, and make... You know, no one was helping you with that thinking, so you thought what you wanted. And you made your own judgments on that, which is fine.
Yeah.
I was going to say, as you grew into sort of adolescence, which is another time of where we're sort of really starting to think about who we are and where we fit in the world, was it something that was really present in your mind often?
Yeah, it was always there, because obviously academically, I did much better than what my brothers did. But it was just always there. It was always that shame. It was always like, it was all right for my mum to tell people I was adopted, but it was in a shameful way. It was in hushed voices. I was ashamed of it. I was absolutely ashamed. You know, because, you know, obviously being pregnant and unmarried in the 1960s, it was a shameful thing, hence the number of adoptions.
Yeah. And so did they, so when you say it was spoken of in hushed terms and whispered voices, was that because you were, you know, were you a naughty child, or you were a disruptive child, or were you just, you know, you said you were an intelligent child. So that's a complex dynamic, isn't it?
No, I wasn't naughty. I was, for many years, as a child, I was certainly the people pleaser. Certainly. Absolutely.
As you moved into adolescence, were your friends and other people aware of you as an adoptee?
No, because I was ashamed. I was so ashamed. And I was so frightened that, you know, I was going to be made more of a victim than I was already. So I was just complete shame over not being wanted, and obviously I picked that up from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And carried and always carried that. I don't now, but certainly for a very long time I did, certainly through adolescence.
So tell me how you feel about adoption in general.
Personally, I understand where there are cases of like abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, where children aren't physically or safe to be with the parents. But if it's in my case, where you've got a newborn with a very young mother whose parents, or she's in a family which will not support her, why not foster the young mother plus the baby, teach the mother how to parent, show her how it can be done, show her an alternative way, like my family, and give her a chance to be with a child and enable that support to be there. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, you've got to get, you know, you've got to get, if she's in a circle of abuse, if she's in domestic violence, domestic abuse, then all of that, or drug taking, or drinking, or whatever addiction it is, it doesn't matter, addictions are addictions. You know, all of that has to change. And if she's always been part of that, then that's going to be a huge weight. But if she truly, truly, really does want to be with a child, then why not take them both on and give them that chance and show them what life can be like? Because, I mean, we're just very working class, very ordinary, and I know that I would be able to do that. With, you know, if somebody came to stay with us with a child, you could show them how to parent and show them, obviously, through my children, you know, how it should be done or how it can be done if you make that choice, and it's all down to choice. I know that women in abusive relationships, it's not just a case of just getting your phone and getting your keys and getting your kids and going. I know that. I know that because they themselves are part of the abusive cycle. So you've got a massive ongoing cycle. You know, and somehow or other, you know, like, you have to be strong and say, actually, this has got to stop. I talk to people who have adopted children and who've relinquished children. And I think I was so angry that it's only been since my dad died that I've been able to talk to people who adopt. Because I think if a child loses a parent in an accident or something, and the parent dies, the child has sympathy, you know, and has help and support and grief. Yet if that child is adopted, it's the same amount of grief, it's the same amount of loss, and yet it's seen as, oh, you know, this is wonderful, don't take this personally, but the people who have adopted you are, you know, are what wonderful people, and what a, you know, wonderful thing to do, and all the things you can have and do, and you've got these fantastic new parents. Well, no, it's not, because that child has gone through loss, and nobody's acknowledged that child's loss.
And in some ways, it's, you know, you would describe it as a chronic loss, in that it's a loss that can't be resolved. Whereas if a parent dies, tragic as that is, there's a conclusion. Whereas if you know that your parent is still alive, and regardless of what that life looks like, they're getting on with it, then it's a loss that can't be brought to a conclusion.
There is no conclusion. Even if you meet your biological parents, there is no conclusion, because I've met both of mine. I met my... But obviously, when I found mine, this is going back to the days pre-internet, so we're going back to... I was 18, so that was 1985, so you're going back 34 years, so there's no internet, all you've got is a phone and a phone book. And though I'd had sight of my adoption, my original birth certificate, that's what I'd seen. I hadn't seen anything else. That's all I saw, was my original birth certificate. And I got that because I applied, because I knew as soon as, you know, I was able, and very early on, sort of 11, 12, that I was going to find my biological parents. I had to find them. And at 18, as soon as I turned 18, I knew that I could have access to my birth records. So you see a social worker, so you know, you just box tick. So I did, and got my original birth certificate. So I got the birth certificate. So I knew what my name had been. I knew where my birth was registered. And I knew what my biological mother's name was. So, and we lived at that point, we lived in Burton, and she, my biological mother, had lived in Sawley, which is near Long Eaton in Nottinghamshire, which isn't far away. So by chance, I saw about a school reunion taking place in Sawley. So I rang the lady and just said, oh, I don't know if you've heard of so-and-so, because obviously I think she went to this school, just made up a bit of a story. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh yes, my husband works at a garage with her, somebody who knows. So she got back to me, and within the weekend I'd found out where she was, and we made the contact. I left my details with this lady and said, oh, if you know this person, give her these details.
Was anyone supporting you through this? I mean, did your adoptive parents know of this, or?
You couldn't talk to them about it.
Yeah.
Couldn't talk to them about it. So I did everything on my own. And that's what I used to do. It's when, even when I was 14, I went to Canada on my own for a month, because they had an aunt and uncle there. So I went to stay with them for a month, and I was 14. It didn't bother me. You know, I had friends, pen friends in those days, in different parts of the country. And even when I was 13, 14, I'd just go to the other side of the country. It didn't bother me. So I wasn't worried. So, no, nobody knew. Nobody knew. And so I phoned her, and I phoned this other lady, and she left my details. She passed my details on via a third person. And within a couple of days, I got a phone call. And the first thing she says, my biological mother said to me, was, can I ask your birth date of birth? And I gave it to her. And obviously she knew who I was then. So I met her.
What were you expecting?
To be honest, and I absolutely hate this programme. You know the reunion programme on TV?
Yeah, Long Lost Families. I don't watch it, but I know.
Don't. It's absolute crap. Sorry. Long Lost Families. I can't watch it. My husband had it on a few times, and he watched it, and he said, oh, Dawn, come and watch. And I said, no way. I was just... ranting, saying this is not true, this isn't how it is, this is just, you know. And so
Disneyfied version of it,
but it's not even that. It's a pingu side. There are no words. And so I just couldn't, because it was such a massive trigger for me. you know, that it was happily ever after, and it just does not like that. And so I went, I met her. She lived in Loughborough. She obviously married at 18. She'd got a daughter 2 years younger than I am, and she'd got a son who's, I think, 12 years younger than I am. So he would have been about 6 or 7 at the time, which coincidentally is the same age as one of my younger children. I went to meet her. I think I saw her a couple of times. The first thing she said to me was, had abortion had been legal, you wouldn't have been here. So at 18, you take that on. And I took it on. So there was somebody else saying, actually, you weren't wanted. Had there been another option, you'd have been binned. Simple as.
That's just catastrophic, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't the best of days, no.
I mean, I have this image of you just alone in the world.
Well, I was, really, till I met my husband, Pete. I met Pete. I mean, I was only 17 when I met Pete, and here we are, 35 years later. But he's been everything. He's, I know he's not perfect. I'm not perfect. A marriage has a lot of ups and downs, but I think, and we've had a lot of downs. And I don't think many other people would have got through what we've got through. I really don't. I really don't. It's because he had a very abusive physical. He wasn't adopted or fostered, but he would have been now because his father was violent. He was an alcoholic. He used to beat him up. But Pete's way of dealing with it is the freeze response and get out. So he won't argue. Very rarely he'll argue. He won't show emotions. So, you know, and he said, he remembers thinking when he was quite young, about 10, thinking family shouldn't be like this, Christmas shouldn't be like this. And so we both had the same thoughts of when we had children. And so our children are everything. Everything works with the children in the centre. And that's the way it is. With all of them. Big, small, middle size, all of them.
So it's hugely informed how you both wanted to build a family.
Yes.
Yeah.
Completely.
So thinking about you as this sort of young woman, to where you are now, which is someone who seems quite reconciled to all of that, you know, to that start, and it, you know, I'm sure, how have you sort of made that journey from what seems like a very raw, very vulnerable place to now where you seem quite articulate and, you know, like you said at the beginning, I'm okay with this now.
I think, yes, I have been through all the phases. I have been through the self-harm bit. I have been through the eating disorder bit. I've had major issues with mental health, which it'll always be there. But over time, I've logicked it out. Over time, I've began to take a step back from my own head and work out what is going on and how I am reacting. And then through research, I read a lot of research papers. I watch people's other behaviour. I've read a lot. But the bottom line is I've logicked and worked out a lot of my own behaviour. And so because I've done it, and there's been the odd shattering moment when I thought, if I looked at my 7-year-old, when Jess, my eldest, is 31 now, when I looked at her when she was 7, and I thought, well, would I blame her if this had happened to her? And I looked at her and she was 7, and it was like, my God, no, I wouldn't. So why do I blame myself? And I was 29, maybe. And so it's like pieces of a million pieces of an unlost puzzle that you just stand in the wind and throw in a field. I think you pick the pieces up, but you have to fit them together your own way. And I know that you know, I've got a very, very, if my children are threatened, that response is immediate. And I do have a, if there's any threat to my children, that it's an immediate response and I will not be challenged where my children are. You can just read people so quickly, so easily, so instantly, that I rely on that and I rely on what a gut feeling is. I watch how people behave. And it's just been a huge learning thing. And I've also learned, most of all, I've learned from my children. I've learned from my children, and I think they have helped heal so much in so many ways because they're brilliant. They are absolutely brilliant people, every single one of them.
I mean, like all parents, proud, but I guess for you there's that added dimension of you feel like you've built something that you didn't have, you and Pete, your husband.
Yes. Yes.
That you've built out of what was sort of a very different childhood. You've built something very positive. Thinking about the future adoption, there's a lot of people talking about, you know, issues around identity, around sort of severance of ties, you know, severance of information, severance of links. Do you think there's a way that children can be cared for by alternative parents and maintain those links? What does that look like? What's your thoughts on that?
It would depend, obviously, on the individual case. If you've got a parent who really, really was beyond help, who wouldn't accept help, just take a step back. So you've got an addict. You don't become an addict overnight. You become an addict because you're in pain of some sort. So unless you could resolve that or balance it or steady it, and that child was in danger, and that parent was prepared to work to become a parent, then if a child's in danger, then I don't know. I think you should maintain ties. Yes, I think you have to maintain ties because at some point in the future, that child is going to want to know. But when I see about children meeting the siblings, I suppose it depends on what age they're separated, you know, because their siblings have all they've known, you know, and if they're separated from the parents and the sibling, that is a major loss. They've lost the parent, they've lost the siblings. Though, if I go back to myself, like, we didn't have social media, and I know full well if I'd had social media, I'd have been on it searching, and then it would have been the contact when I was too young, when it wasn't expected, when it was uncontrolled. I mean, it was uncontrolled anyway, what I've done, because I have met both bio parents, though I'm in touch with my father and my half-sister.
I mean, how did that come about? Sorry to divert you, because it sounds like it was quite interesting is a nice way of putting it, a difficult meeting with your mum, and that's not continued, your biological mum.
No.
How did that then move into you finding your father? And
well, to be quite honest, it never crossed my mind until I was 29 that I thought, I've got a father. I was 29, I remember thinking, because I'd had an accident, and so I was off. I couldn't weight bear on my right leg because I'd had quite a bad accident, and so I had a bit of thinking time. And when you have thinking time, it's dangerous for me. And I had a lot of thinking time, and I thought, well, where is he? So I then found out, bearing in mind you're still pre-internet, so I found out that I could get access to my birth record, which I didn't know. So I applied for that, and I was expecting this great big thick file of information, and it came really quickly, and I was so excited. I remember feeling so excited that I'm going to get some information about me, and all I got was like a paragraph of a photocopy that had been ripped across the bottom, and I got a paragraph of my birth mother's name and address at that time, which I knew, and his name and his address. Well, no, his name. I think it was his name at the time and where he lived. That was it. And that was it. And I was devastated because I thought, that's me in a paragraph. Mm. It's just like six lines. That's me. And that was it. And so I did the same thing. Because his brother, I found him via his sister-in-law, his brother had married somebody with an unusual name, used the telephone book, went through them in the book, there was only two or three, phoned them, do you know this person? Oh yeah, he's married to so-and-so, and passed my details on. So within a weekend, again, I met him. But that's been very on and off.
What were you expecting from that meeting in comparison to the meeting with your mum? Was it, I mean, you were 10 years older, weren't you?
Yeah, it didn't make any difference. I was still stupid. it was naivety of thinking long lost families as in this is going to be happily ever after, and which is why that is just so unreal. Why don't they, but the real version isn't, I suppose, what people want. They want the nice chocolatey, you know, sit, put your feet up, watch TV. Well, it isn't.
Swirling music and gushing feelings.
Yeah, and it isn't like that. So I met him, and we've had contact sort of off and on, but it's, I think, because obviously recently we lost our 11-week-old granddaughter, my biological father, Alan, came from Belgium. He lives in Brussels, for her funeral, and I didn't know he was going to be there. And I said, I'd met him briefly. I'd gone into to get some town, to get some cash, and I'd walked past him once. And I came out, and I heard somebody say, Dawn, and I turned round, and I looked. And Pete was there with me as well, and he said, it's Alan. And I said to him, I just burst into tears because I don't cry, but when I'm caught out, I'll cry. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, why do you think? And I said, we've lost Coral. And he said, that's why I'm here. I've come for a funeral. And so he sat with us in church. With my children, my family, because obviously they hadn't met him. So.
That's hugely emotive time for you as a family, but for him to come as well it's a lot of stuff there, isn't there?
Just a bit. Yeah. And so. Because my Dulcie, who I've mentioned, she has questioned me endlessly about him. But all of my children, a lot of them, are in contact with, like, my cousins, nieces, nephews, because they're only in Derby, which is not far from where we are. So they're in...
Your biological cousins and nieces?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. They're all in contact. My kids are. But obviously, they're not the ones affected by the adoption. They just know that they are biologically related. Because I hadn't had anybody look like me until I had my own children. And so when they met, obviously, Alan, it was like, they were just like... Because the older ones have met him, the oldest five, but the younger ones can't remember. And... or haven't met him. Well, actually, most of them have met him. And they were just dulcy. They were just so shocked that you look like somebody else instead of just looking at me, looking them looking like me and me looking like them. It was like, you look like somebody else. It's like, so... And I also think because he's getting a bit older now and I think he's had a heart attack and I think he's seeing life a little bit differently. And also, I can air my thoughts on adoption, and I've made it quite clear that it's not in disrespect to him, but these are my views of adoption, though he had no control at all over that. He had no control, because obviously on my birth certificate, it says father unknown. That's why I didn't know. Originally at 18 that I could get access to my birth records because that wasn't told to me, wasn't explained. So I hadn't thought about him because I thought, where do you go with father unknown if you're not in contact with your bio mother, because she was very edgy and sketchy with information as well. And she blamed that she had major mental health issues, which is sad. But she blamed me for it. That was something else she blamed me for. So now I wouldn't take it, and now I'd say no. It probably wouldn't have worked out anyway, because she was never able to deal with the impact that her relinquishment had caused. But had she had the support, had her parents have supported her? I didn't even know until very recently, as in 6 weeks ago maybe, where I was born. Because when my adopted dad died, he was meticulous with paperwork, and he kept everything was in order. And my adoption records were being thrown out in a bag of stuff, and I found them. My adoption record. And I didn't even know where I was born until about 6 weeks ago. It was Chapel Town. And it was when we picked my son up, Peter, from uni, we were coming back, and I saw a sign saying Chapel Town. And I said to Peter, and Pete, my husband, knew it was Chapel Town too. And he just looked, because he knew I'd seen it. And I thought, that I was born in Leeds. I was born in Leeds. I didn't know. And all the way back from Leeds, I was saying, my God, I was born in Leeds. I didn't know, and I was born in Leeds. I didn't know where I was born.
Which is information that but the vast majority of people just take for granted. It's just, it's not even a question. But for you, it's, and I think talking to lots of adoptees recently for the podcast is this idea that adoptees don't own their story. They don't. It's just incomplete, and they hear different versions, and it's almost like even when they get to, it takes years, like you, it takes years, and you're still not at the bottom of it. You still can't get certainty around what actually happened and who said what. And it's catastrophic.
I think part of you can't accept it. You can't let it go. And so you're fighting your own self in your own head. And I did that for a long time. So you've got this constant battle in your head with yourself, and then other bits of yourself will join in. So you're constantly fighting in your head with yourself, you know, taking other people out of the argument. You are constantly fighting in your head, which leads to so many problems, which leads to so much rage, which leads to so much anger. And so there just comes a point, and you think, well, right, fair enough, get on with it. You know, I think for a long time I thought my biological mother would contact me again, but now I don't think that. You cannot make up for lost time, because the time has gone. It's past, it's finished, it's over. If anything, I'd be angry because she wasn't strong enough, because I'd die before anybody took my children. I would die. I think the anger is probably towards her, but then I think the anger's moved to society, it's moved to private adoptions, it's moved to how wrong this is and how naive and don't take this the wrong way. Some people who adopt, so they've got a child for a few months and think they know everything there is to know about parenting. Collectively, I've probably got about 170 years of parenting. So that's like 340 between me and Pete. People will say to me, you've got 10 children, you must know everything about being a mum. And I say, no, you never do. And so it really, really puts my back up when people get, I can understand them protecting, but with the social media, I do think they overshare. I think oversharing, because it's so easy, and I've seen it happening, that people who've relinquished the child have managed to find out where that child is at school and where she is. though they have, they're allowed a letter once a year, which I think is barbaric. Why not just supported the mum? Why not just helped her through it? Why not take them both on? You know, why not just do that? And her little girl was seven, and because one of my little girls are seven, I would think, how would she cope? How would she cope? And so, it's difficult because I don't think as a young person, even though I knew, I could have handled it. I really don't. And I think of the people adopting, I think if they listen to people who are willing to share quite openly and not, and who are older, I think as you get a bit older, you get a bit cleverer with your words and how you come across. And I think the rage bit, though it's still there, I think you use it in a different way. And I think a lot could be learned by listening and learning and being willing to talk to people like me who would share everything and say, this is how it is and this is what it's done. And so when your adopted child does this, this is probably why, what's going on in their head. Because I remember that 3, 4, 5, 20, 30, 40-year-old. And it doesn't go away. It is trauma. Your brain's rewired, and that's it.
Yeah, because we can argue a lot about, you know, well, I hear the debates rage, and you see the people saying, well, it's different now, and it's this and it's that. But the fundamental is that children are removed from parents, and the system is irrelevant, that it's that, like you... You're a four-year-old and you know that you're not with your biological parents, and you know things are not how they should be. So you do understand. You have a unique insight to what it is like to live, be raised by strangers in the first instance.
Well, they were. They were. And they remain so now. They remain so now. So... I'm not in contact with my adoptive brother. Well, I've cut ties. I've cut ties. It just got more and more nasty. And I thought, this is good. I can see the path this is going down. It's not resolvable. And I'm not going to be the one who's going to keep trying to resolve. Because obviously I was still trying to resolve and still trying to play the game to keep everybody happy. So I thought, screw this, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it anymore. And I refuse to. My children can understand that with my brother, so that's that finished. It's difficult because they live where we live, but that's just the way it's got to be, because I'm not playing his games anymore. I can get on with it. But as for contact, sorry, what did you ask? Sorry.
No, it was just it was more of a comment and around your unique position, your unique understanding of what it is to live as a person who's brought up with a different family. And that's what we need to hear. As an adopter, that's what I need to hear.
You can't cure it.
No.
It's just something that's there. I mean, you can... I mean, and equally, there are people who have been in successful, you know, and are happy adoptions, but they've still got similar problems to me. So, but I think if you've got a better understanding, then that can only help you as an adopter.
Yeah.
It can only help you because you said you've changed, and that's good. Because we all change as parents, because you can't be the person you were however many years it was when you first adopted your children, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know, I would go for 20. You're not the same person then as you are now, nor would you expect to be. So the way you parent and the way I've parents changed, how I used to be when I was had my first one, to second, to third, to fourth, to fifth, you know, it changed. It just changed with time. and how I am now. It's changed with time. The only way is having my own family. My own family. And it's like when the kids have been asked to do like family tree homeworks, but I always get a funny response, and not a sarcastic, nasty response, aggressive response. It's just a funny response, and speak to the teacher and laugh, and so then they'll listen. Whereas if you go in like aggressively, they're not going to listen. So you've got to go in with a bit of humour. I'm not laughing at it or at myself. I'm just laughing at the homework, as in you've got to draw your family tree. Well, that's easy. We don't have one. Where it? And often, whenever it's helped come up, that the teacher, when I've spoke to them, they've been mortified. They've been very apologetic, saying, oh, I'm really sorry, I had no idea. But I think with more and more children being in care and placed for adoption, I think they've got to start thinking. They've got, education system has got to start thinking. And, I mean, I don't know what the percentage of people who are adopted is currently, or fostered. But I assume it's significant, and everybody's got to cater for it, because when you understand people's behaviour, it changes your whole perception. Because when like I said, you've got a sixth sense when people are struggling, you just know, and so you'll say, "Is everything okay?" or "Is there anything I can do?" and that changes the dynamics of any conversation completely, and that's the way it is, and that's the way my children are, but they've got that from me.
I'm really conscious of the time, and I really appreciate your openness and honesty, and I think you've got a really insightful understanding of yourself and kind of your journey through life, even though you don't necessarily have all the details or the facts. So thank you so much for coming on. It's really appreciated.
Yeah. Can I just say, it's made me the mum I am. It's made me the person I am. And I like to think of it in that way. I wouldn't have been who I am without everything that's happened. And from that, my children benefit, and they are the people they are, because of who I am.
That's a good news story.
Mm.
Thank you.
All right. All right. No problem.